Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Kids learn today's gaming skills for play and keyboard skills for jobs. They'll all be virtual workers unless the world doesn't turn out that way. Under the shadow of ever-rising oil prices, an unstable climate, and an economy held up by magic balloons, how should we prepare our kids? Tracy Mayer is a parent who writes for a living, her work appearing in such diverse publications as Salon, Computer World, and the Boston Globe. Her latest book, Mommy Prayers, captures the humorous desperation of motherhood. I found Tracy through the New York Times under the headline, Preparing Kids for the Apocalypse. That was kind of a steal from Tracy's original work in Brain Child magazine, which she edits, titled Armageddon Mama, Parenting Toward the Apocalypse. With my own family, I often wonder, what the hell should I tell the kids about all this? Should I try to aim them toward college or learning to make their own shoes? Let's try and sort some of this out person to person. Tracy Mayer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
I notice you actually defend the suburbs. Didn't you get the memo that suburbia is toast in America?
Well, actually, I'm in the suburbs and not really in a position to leave. So I think, you know, you try to make do with what you have. But actually, a lot of the reading I did said that, you know, if something were to come down, the suburbs might not be a bad place to be. So hopefully we've made the right decision.
We just got a bit of a breakthrough here in our city where one of our mayors has come out and said, go ahead, plant your front lawn with gardens and your back lawn, and we'll encourage you. You could even do commercial gardening. I've been waiting for that day for 30 years.
Oh, right. And at least where we are, you know, I'm sure it's happening everywhere. The chicken phenomenon is on the rise, where people are getting a couple of chickens in their backyards. And my son is dying to get two little pygmy goats or a sheep, but we have a really crazy dog, so we have to wait for the dog to move on to to a different lifestyle before we can get any pets.
I get you. Well, what got you interested in the basics of survival?
Well, as I say in the beginning of the article in Brainchild magazine, we had an ice storm, it was actually not an ice storm, it was a blowdown. In the winter last February, and we were without power for, I think, 3.5 days, and some places in our town were five days. And just that tiny little experience of having, you know, no heat and lights for 3.5 days was enough to be like, wow. And that's when we realized, sort of by tromping down into our basement, that our stash of stuff that we had put in there after 9/11, when we were told to do so, had just been completely pillaged. You know, my kids had taken we had all these batteries, those went to the game controllers, and we'd, you know, taken our canned goods and given them to the food bank at some point, and we had water, we used that for a, you know, school event. There was very little down there. We couldn't even find our flashlights, so we said, wow, we are really clueless here. If something happened on some kind of semi-permanent level, we would be toast.
I'm hoping there is a quiet revolution going on in people's expectations. What are you hearing from parents about the future and their kids?
Well, you know, I think it's a real mixed bag. Speaking as Brainchild's editor, we're an alternative parenting magazine, and we have a very highly educated and really thoughtful readership, which we love. And I would say that those people, it's not that they're hunkering down in some kind of cellar that they've dug out, but they're very up on climate change issues. I think they're very, very up on thoughtful parenting and trying to, you know, really prepare kids beyond these sort of milestones that we're told to expect, you know, with good college and all that kind of stuff. They're really trying to raise good people. At the same time, when that article was picked up, it was mentioned in the New York Times in their Motherlode blog, which is also a very thoughtful place. Many, many people there and many people I know personally said that something like thinking about some kind of disaster and your children had not crossed their mind once, ever. So I think there's a pretty wide range of reactions.
Your article in Brainchild magazine wasn't the puff piece we so often see. I noticed you did your homework and you tracked down some useful information. For example, I didn't know about Sean Broderick's new book, The Ultimate Suburban Survivalist Guide. What is that about?
I actually loved that book. I actually went out and bought another copy for my dad because it's right up his alley. I did an interview with him, and he said, I think he's, you know, he's kind of up on all of this, you know, disasters. He's a financial columnist. But he pointed out, he lives in Florida. He has two younger kids. They're, I think they're both still in elementary school. He lives in Florida, and he said, look, you know, we're a lot closer to the edge down here. There's, you know, the potential for different kinds of citizen unrest is a lot closer to the surface. Their recession has been very, very bad down there, as I think everyone knows. The potential for all kinds of weather-related disasters is much closer, and, you know, they've had hurricanes come roaring through there, and he said, you know, you really have a closer sense than other places of things sort of falling apart and maybe not coming back together. So his point about the suburbs, I asked him, well, how come you picked the suburbs? He said, that's where a lot of people are right now, and it's kind of, you can't pick up your house and move it once a disaster starts to roll, either something, a weather-related disaster or some kind of longer-term economic societal thing. You are where you are. So he was, that book is just full of great tips, and of course we haven't really done too many of them yet, but I like the idea of them.
Well, you've brought up something that always bugs me. There's this persistent narrative about the coming breakdown. Brave men, followed by their hard-cooking women, take off into Montana to defend the compound with high-powered guns. Is that really what happens when society goes into a period of stress?
Well, actually, I interviewed a professor called Stephanie Kuntz, who's really good, and she's done a lot of research about families in present-day and families in the past. And she said, you know, even our myth, at least in the United States, this sort of myth of the wide open frontier and people just lighting out and leaving society behind is actually, it is a myth. The West was built with a lot of government support and government intervention, and it's not true that it was cowboys running around shooting each other. There was quite a lot of organized law enforcement that was going on there, and people building roads and bridges and you know, building town wells and all that kind of societal stuff. So she was one of many people I talked to who said it's not, first of all, there's no place to go. If you're living, I live in a small town of 8,000 people, but if you've got 8,000 people all out in the same town square trying to forage for mushrooms or acorns or whatever, you're not going to make it, and that's what she said. She said you can't forage your way out of a disaster. You need to work with other people.
And again, you brought up another good book, Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. How does that help us? What can she tell us?
Yeah, that was another fabulous book. I just got to read a lot of books for this. It was a great article. Her book was really fascinating. Darkness and light at the same time. And she studied, I think, five different disasters starting from the earthquake in San Francisco in the 1900s and moving up through Katrina. And what she found is that the ordinary people, you will be depending on your neighbors. And by that, she means your physical, the people who are physically next to you when some kind of event happens. And, you know, not your virtual, your Facebook crowd or the people who follow your Twitter feed or your blogger readers. It's really going to be the people next to you physically. And that people form alliances with other people who have like needs. So if you and the person standing next to you are both trying to get out of a flood zone and you have your pet with you, and the National Guard has said, don't bring your pet, you're not allowed to bring your pet, well, suddenly you are an ally with this person who also has a dog, so the two of you can start problem-solving together. And that's what she said she's found, is that ordinary people actually do extraordinary things and kind of reach across divides when they see a commonality.
Did you find some survival strategies coming from families in the Great Depression of the 1930s?
Well, same thing. That was also Professor Kuntz. She said that people really needed to share, and that it was partly a matter of being altruistic and being, you know, moral and upstanding and all those things that we hope we would be in a disaster. But it was also, if you're afraid that you're not a person who would have those good things come out in them, It's just a matter of practicality. If you share what you have with your neighbor, you're banking that that person is going to share with you when they get something. So she said, you know, when they got a sack of flour, they would share it among many, many families. They wouldn't hoard it because you can't do anything with just the flour. You need some leavening agent and you need some sugar and then you need a little bit of meat with that. And, you know, so you need to share not just for the good karma, but also because it's a practical necessity.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with New England author and journalist Tracy Mayer. And let's get back to the focus of getting kids ready for difficult times. As you point out, today's kids are likely overweight and mostly divorced from nature, no outside time. What can parents do to prepare them?
Well, I don't know. You know, I didn't really come up with any hard and fast solutions. I mean, I think obviously it helps for your kid to have a wide range of skills. Sean Broderick, who wrote the Suburban Survivalist book, he said, you know, your kid doesn't have to be able to do all kinds of, you know, they don't need to know how to shoot a deer with a bow and arrow, but they should have one or two things that they know how to do. And the kids should have some time outdoors in nature, sort of away from a mediated environment. I know Richard Love's book, which a lot of people know, Last Child in the Woods, he laments that even kids who do spend time outside, you know, they're spending it on a sort of organized surface. They're on a sidewalk or they're on a soccer field, something that's been groomed and taken care of. And just the act of getting out beyond something that's controlled, very visibly controlled by humans, is enough for people to start thinking, you know, outside the box a little. I know my own kids at their school, they have a Project Adventure program. You know, it's kind of an outward bound thing. It's small. It's not, they don't go for weeks, but they do have, it's a ropes course. And I mean, it's also team building and trusting your fellow student and all that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of schools have that now, but if your school doesn't, it's a great thing to push for.
Yes, you point out a couple of rays of hope that some schools, including private schools and public schools, are looking towards more practical training, a little bit anyway.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the Montessori and the Waldorf traditions in the elementary and preschool are very hands-on based. And a lot of kindergartens, in my experience, preschool and kindergarten, they still have kids doing stuff with their hands. But what I found that was kind of a bummer is that when you start around middle school, at least in our state, and I think a lot of others, you really start to push this high academia, which is great. You want your kid to be learning all these things, but sometimes it comes at the expense of what we used to call home ec and shop class. So I am trying to get my kids to take the very few offerings that our school still has. There's a class at the high school where they teach you how to repair, like, lawnmowers and small motors, and I think that's fabulous. So I'm wrestling with my older son now to get him to, you know, drop one of his AP classes and take that class.
What is an AP class?
Oh, advanced placement. It's one of those, you know, it's run by the same people who run the SAT classes. It's a high-level academic course, and they're very difficult, but supposedly they make your college transcript look terrific to admissions officers.
Okay, so in some of your research here, another question I have, and I wonder if some of the people talked about this, is how we talk to our kids about our fears for the future. You know, mommy or daddy comes off the computer looking pretty worried, saying, oh boy, we're in big trouble. What do we say?
Well, it's interesting because I saw from your earlier shows that you've talked about that pathological optimism. That's one I'm personally still wrestling with. You don't want to paint a picture that's unnecessarily rosy or just say, oh, hey, let's all go about our consumerist ways and some geek is going to think up some wonderful solution to this. But at the same time, you don't want to depress your kids. They got a lot on their minds already. I mean, you know, the teen years and even early 20s, there's a lot of stuff going on. So I think we're just trying to strike a tone of awareness. And also, I think, appreciativeness of what we do have. I really try to have my kids not take what we have for granted and try to live sort of low to the earth. I think I mentioned in my article, you know, we do, you know, the sort of regular things that you would hope a lot of families do. We recycle, we compost, we belong to a community garden organization where we get our vegetables 6 months of the year. that kind of stuff. You hope that your kids just absorb that and think of that as a normal way to live. We keep the heat really low in our house, which drives my older son crazy. So, you know, try to do those awareness things and then also try to hope that they will choose something in life that's somehow working toward the solution, being part of the solution, somehow paying back into society, and hopefully they can be one of the people who comes up with some kind of solution to this.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Kathy McMahon. She's sort of the peak oil shrink. And at her talk, I was surprised to find so many women in the audience, and they were really educated about our dependence on oil and the fact it might run out someday. And many of their questions were, how do we talk to our relatives and our workplace friends about this without being just sort of shoved into that box of Armageddon Mama?
Right. I mean, it is. I have a lot of people, including my close friends, kind of rolling their eyes and saying, oh my gosh, why are you writing about that? And I don't know, you know, I mean, it's very hard not to have people be skeptical, but I guess it's just sort of small things, day-to-day things, and then trying to move people along. We've, in our town, just in our tiny town, we switched from a volunteer recycling program to an enforced recycling program. And people screamed and yelled as if you were cutting off one of their legs. But I just noticed in my neighborhood when I was walking my dog, all these people who never recycled as much as a milk jug, the second there was a dollar figure attached to it, they were out there with their bin full to the top. So, I mean, people do change, and I think you can sort of pick one thing and then add the other one on and hopefully go from there. I mean, I feel like I need to remain optimistic about this even when some of the information is overwhelming.
Is there something I've missed, Tracy, something you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
I did mention this in my own story at the end, and we haven't talked about him, which is funny. Bill McKibben, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners are already well familiar with, I had the honor of being able to interview him for this story, and he has a new book out called Earth, which is with two A's. It's E-A-A-R-T-H, and that book was fantastic, I felt. It's actually a short book. It's a difficult read. He kind of paints the picture, the reality of where we are now, and it's very heartbreaking. But the second half of his book is a lot of what we've talked about, is sort of prescriptions for soldiering on, living on this tough new planet. I think that's actually the subtitle of the book. And I'm just trying to get as many people as I can to read that book. I think it's really fantastic. And his organization is 350.org, which I follow along with, and I try to get a lot of my friends to as well. They're very positive, activist, upbeat, and trying to get things going.
Very good. There you go. You can get the kids ready for college or the medieval ages or both. Our guest is Tracy Mayer. Her latest book is Mommy Prayers. And don't put that down until you've tried hurting little feet while getting up five times a night. Tracy has serious articles in many places, but she always seems to bring a dry sense of humor into that darkness. Find her really thoughtful article, Armageddon Mama, at brainchildmag.com and follow her own work at tracymayer.com. Tracy, thank you for helping us out.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. There is some savage financial news out there. In my show blog for this week at ecoshock.info, I've linked to just a half dozen stories you might have missed. Consider it your homework assignment. Roadmap that opens up shadow banking by Gillian Tett of the Financial Times. You won't believe what these geniuses were up to, the extent of the fantasy and fraud in the banking system. Which leads up to a piece from the Wall Street Journal, quote, U.S. in vast insider trading probe, and especially an excellent expose by Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica. The title is Banks Self-Dealing Supercharged Financial Crisis. It is a long piece with a complete explanation of the fraudulent collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs, trillions of dollars of fantasy money stashed away in bank vaults as assets. The Federal Reserve, on orders by George Bush and then Obama, has purchased up to $40 billion worth of this junk from the banks, and they are still sunk. As the truth comes out, banks worldwide could collapse, in my opinion. It may take years, or it may just take days. Shed a tear for the Irish people who just found that out. Meanwhile, I've linked to Bloomberg's stories, prime U.S. mortgage foreclosures hit record, as unemployment hurts finances, and U.S. homeowners drop out of foreclosure program amid record defaults, with a final flourish of unemployment benefits to end for 2 million Americans. Whew, okay, so let's get a little good news in here, and there are drops of good news. Despite the collapse, some of the world's largest solar plants are now starting operation. Sun Edison claims the largest single solar facility in Rovigo, Italy, at 70 megawatts. Well, the biggest in Europe, anyway. Germany has the largest overall facility with several linked solar farms. In fact, Germany and Spain lead the world in solar power. Canada seems to have set a new record, opening an 80-megawatt solar farm in Sarnia, Ontario. It's up there and it's going and it's beautiful. The U.S. is way down the list, with the largest being a 25-megawatt solar plant in Arcadia, Florida. But Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced approval for what will be the world's largest solar thermal plant in California, the Blythe Solar Power Project in the Mojave Desert. We have taken the first baby steps. Part of the great healing is to reestablish our relationship with growing food. The process is good for us, as is the organic produce. Like a great ice field cracking open, the impregnable icon of the lawn is starting to fall. In just one example, the city of North Vancouver is encouraging residents to tear out their lawns and plant food gardens. City Councillor Craig Keating has raised bed gardens in his front yard. The city even allows commercial farming of home yards. One company called City Farm Boy leases yards and even rooftops to grow vegetables. Homeowners get a share of the fresh goodies, as do 38 shareholders, paying an annual fee for their weekly basket of veggies from May to October. This is earth-shaking. People can stop poisoning their lawns, start composting their waste, and begin tasting real vegetables right at home. It didn't travel thousands of carbonated miles. I'm going to play you a clip from the radio show Unwelcome Guests, Hour 2 of show number 523. It is an interview of critical mass biker and Frisco lifestyle changer Chris Carlson. He is talking about his new book, Nowtopia, how pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today. We'll tune in as Chris explains the urban gardening scene in the United States.
The gardening movement's an interesting one because it represents something of a reclaiming of the commons. And people went, you know, you go back to World War II, I can back up even further, but I'll just start it there. You know, we had this big victory gardens movement in the United States instigated by the federal government because they wanted people to grow more food to help the war effort. And everybody, you know, for a great number of people, that was how they could contribute, was by growing food. And what, by the end of World War II, 45% of the fresh produce consumed by Americans was growing in urban gardens. So when we think about a kind of a systematic transition toward a more relocalized life in which we produce the things we need locally amongst ourselves and practical things like food and energy and transportation and communications is really what I'm talking about here. The food model of having, think of cities as urban food forests. They could be. We could actually probably top that 45% number if there was a, you know, kind of like a let's go to the moon type mentality about let's grow food in cities. Now, where would we do that? In just in vacant lots? I mean, that's where the movement starts, is vacant, you know, People's Park in 1969 in Berkeley. One of the first things they do after they take this fence down from the university to put up around a lot is they plant a urban organic garden. And that influences people all across the country. And pretty soon you have people doing this in vacant lots all over the place. And it's not new knowledge. It's actually very often connecting to the elders in the community who had already had a great experience of learning about the local ecology, putting their hands in the soil, figuring out what would grow in the specific areas with the specific microclimates and soil conditions and water availability, et cetera. And that knowledge got transmitted across the generations in these gardens. And now you have, from the 70s onward, this proliferation of community gardens all over the major cities of the United States. Now we live this totally fragmented and atomized life in which everybody's moving all the time, either moving from job to job or home to home. And there's not that sense of stability, and there's not that sense of knowing each other. And if you want to talk about sort of, you know, movements for serious political change in our culture, you really need to have stable communities that know each other and trust each other so they can envision it from below. It can't be something just imposed from on high. And so this breakdown in the working class left a bunch of things behind, which was destroyed communities and urban life in back east. There was these giant riots in the late 60s, and they burned down parts of the cities. And then the landlords burned down other parts of the cities. And the city's administrations in New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and places like that abandoned whole areas out of this sort of spatial deconcentration and you know, racism and other obvious factors. And so the people left behind, oftentimes, you know, women-centered communities, slowly but surely start to rebuild their sense of community life. And one of the ways they did that was by invading these empty lots that had been abandoned, that were full of needles and broken glass and cement and rubble, and clearing them and realizing this is a great space for a garden, for a space for our kids to play, but we have to clear it out. So they would spend a lot of, you know, community would come together to do that. They would plant beautiful flowers and trees, and then they would start thinking they could grow food there, and people would meet there across generations and across ethnicities and across different musical tastes and all sorts of different things. And then you have these amazing thriving spaces, and they really proliferated. You had over 1,000 of them in just in New York City. In San Francisco, we have about 120. You know, there's huge areas of Detroit now that are under the control of what's called the Detroit Agricultural Network, and they're actually farming with tractors because there's so much empty land there. And Philadelphia has another, you know, 900 gardens and so on. And you can just find this story in every city. And in these gardens, then, you have these new communities, and you have people actually thinking about food security and really producing things for their own needs. And something really beautiful starts to happen with that. And then, unfortunately, there's the underside of this story, which is private property, because finally these vacant lots are not common lands. They're actually owned by somebody, usually. Either the cities repossess them and are waiting for somebody to develop them into tax-producing revenue streams, or they're privately owned, and the private owners eventually come back and go, wow, thank you for starting this beautiful garden and bringing the neighborhood back from the brink. Now I can sell this, or I can turn it into a, you know, spot for, this is great. The neighborhood's gentrifying. My land's gone way up in value. Thank you so much. I'll take it back now. And if you haven't, you know, taken the opportunity when it was worth nothing to really get ownership over it and actually end ownership over it, that is to say, put it into the public commons through either a land trust scenario or public ownership or something, well, you lose. And that's what happened to a number of gardens, although by no means all of them in New York City. A recent case in L.A. happened, a 300-acre garden down in L.A. across from a food bank was repossessed by the owner through some shenanigans with city council down there. And now, one of the things I like to emphasize is there's a huge amount of common land in every city that people don't really recognize it as such, because it's covered in asphalt and it serves one basic purpose, which is to house private automobiles and occasionally move them. And that's an absurd use of public space. Absolutely absurd. It's a really inefficient and poorly thought out use of urban infrastructure and urban space. So at least as a starting point, I think one of our next tasks is essentially to reassert some control over that common space and for other purposes than merely the shuttling around or parking forever of private automobiles. And instead think of that as the starting point for urban food forests. And what could we grow if we started shrinking streets to half their size? Maybe not every street, but, you know, many of them could be shrunk a lot. And that new space opened up could be the place where people are growing food and planting fruit trees and free fruit in every city. And I think as we go forward in our society with all the obvious crises ahead of us, with water, fresh water issues, with arable soil issues, with crashing availability of energy, et cetera, and I'm not a catastrophist. I don't think all this stuff's happening overnight, and I don't think it's going to happen all, you know, in a way that we can't ameliorate it and move forward in interesting ways together. It seems like a pretty good idea to start taking some systematic action towards relocalizing food production as much as we could, including in cities.
That was an interview with Chris Carlson, author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Find his blog at nowtopians.com. It's really hopeful. And read more in the zine, Processed World. Growing food helped save me. It can help you too. Start small at home, find a community garden, find a community right where you live. We're going out with a music mix that's hard to beat, the famed gospel singer Mavis Staples. I'm Alex Smith. Don't tell me you are down and out. Not when you've got that light inside. Let it shine.
Shine on me, let the light from the lighthouse shine on me.